This is a production of Cornell University.
Welcome. You probably heard the chimes have already played God Bless America today in honor of 9/11, but they played it three times. And I remember that day that before Twitter and Facebook, but we had email, a notice went out saying that there would be a candlelight vigil on the Arts Quad. And 13,000 people showed up for that moment. And I know there are people here who were in some way affected by 9/11, either in a distant way or a very intimate way, and that this is a day for meditation and reflection. And for those of you who came anyway, I want to welcome you especially to our what I think is going to be a joyous event that we call Shop Talk. And welcome all the rest of you as well. I think everybody knows that world literature has been written without the advice, or most of world literature has been written without the advice of an English professor. But at this very moment in our history, very little is published without the advice and help of the editors and agents, which is what we have here today. We have one poet who's an editor, one literary agent, and an editor at a major American literary press. I ask you to wait a moment while I give you a few of their credentials, and perhaps they'll tell you something more. I think if I was looking at John, he's telegraphing to me that I should mention the Zelazniks.
Yes.
Yes. David and Barbara Zelaznik are the supporters of our entire reading series, and this is our first event. So thank you to them. First, I'd like to welcome John Hennessy, who teaches at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, is also a poet who's published two collections of poetry, Coney Island Pilgrims and Bridge and Tunnel, and who in 2011 founded a pretty remarkable literary magazine that's both a print journal and a digital journal. The Common. And I think he should be the one to tell you where that wonderful name comes from and what it signifies. But it signifies a common area among other things, as well as some other interesting things. The Common has published in only 3+ years hundreds and hundreds of writers and also published graphic work. There are so many that I can't name them all, but I picked a selection, beginning with James Franco. That James Franco. I know he's ubiquitous, isn't he? What must it be like to be James Franco? Major Jackson, Brett Anthony Johnson, David Lehman. That seems very cunning because he's the editor of Best American Poetry, but also a major American poet. Pablo Neruda. Obviously dead, but they have a translation. Grant, and have been doing translations. Don Scher, who was here a year ago. Mary Jo Salter, Teresa Svoboda, Edith Wharton, and many other hundreds of people. And
yeah, no idea how hard it is to get any work from her.
Right now, they're publishing Aishan Hutchinson. So this is a very impressive list, and he's even more impressive than Edith Wharton. We're also welcoming Valerie Borchardt from the George Borchardt Agency. It was founded by George and Anne Borchardt in 1967. Its original list of authors, not surprisingly, was dominated by people who were French or writing in French. And some of these people are still represented by the agency under states. And it includes, it's amazing, Barthes, Samuel Beckett, Pierre Bourdieu, Deleuze, Marguerite Duras, Foucault, Ionesco, was Romanian but wrote in French, Lacan, Robrier, Sartre, Elie Wiesel. I mean, that's just a selection of the astounding list that they have. Presently, most of their writers are English language writers, and they include poets and scholars as well as fiction writers. John Ashbery, Robert Bly, T. Gregerson Boyle, Joan Jacobs Blumberg, who's an emeritus professor here, Mary Capodangra, Robert Coover, Stanley Crouch, Charles Johnson, Pulitzer Prize winner, Fred Kaplan, Tracy Kidder, Ian McEwan, Susan, did she say Minow or
Minot?
Minot. I didn't get it right on the second try.
Right.
Susan Minot, John Retchie, Richard Rodriguez, George Steiner, Judy Troy, and again, Elie Wiesel. But I'm saving the best for last, Adam Price, who's in this room today.
And Stephanie Vaughn.
And Stephanie Vaughn. And then Ethan Nosowski from Grey Wolf Press, not New York, but a much greater city, Minneapolis. You're now in Minneapolis rather than St. Paul?
They are in Minneapolis, but I work for them from California.
You work from California. That's going to bring up the digital question we were just talking about. An astounding list that Grey Wolf has. I'll just read a few. Elizabeth Alexander, Robert Bly, Robert Boswell, Kate Braverman, Joseph Campagna, Vikram Chandra, Martha Collins, Mark Dotti, Gerald Burley, Alice Fulton from Cornell, Dana Joya, Rachel Ingalls, Khaled Matawa, Harriet Mullen, Carl Phillips, Salvatore Shibona, Charles Simic, Tracy K. Smith, Melanie Ray Thon, Tron Stone, Nobel Prize, Natasha Trethewey. Also, James Franco. Rilke, Dante, and J. Robert Lennon. the poster you may have read announcing this says, Shop Talk, learn the ins and outs of the publishing industry with literary agent Valerie Borchardt and editors John Hennessy and Ethan Nosowski. These experts will share their experience and will talk about the kind of writing that grabs their attention. Bring your questions. Well, we're going to ask each of them to speak and then open this up to your questions. But I thought we might begin with a big question that you can do whatever you want to with, which is what you, as people who see a side of the profession we don't see, think is happening to the book as an artifact? Is it going to disappear? Should we be selling our bookcases and giving our books to the Friends of the Library sale? Is it already gone? Are fiction and poetry going to disappear, even in their virtual form? Are we going to have only YouTube readings, that is, will everything devolve into a performance? Or do you see something else happening, maybe things happening simultaneously, maybe there's a spectrum of possibilities? I thought we might start with John,
Sure.
because you're working in both the digital and...
Right, and I can keep it specific to what we do. If you see, and I have free copies that I'll bring to the reception, this is a beautifully designed magazine. It comes out twice a year, but we also do digital simultaneous free publication, okay? And our philosophy is that if you want to buy a book, you'll buy a book. If you're going to read it online and that's how you like to read, please read what we offer, please do. And we also offer online content that is not in the print journal. 5 days a week, new material. I do a monthly poetry feature. Sometimes it's a single author, sometimes as many as 10. And we're going to do a couple of anthologies this way, with, say, 3 monthly installments. We'll do one on Chinese poetry coming up very soon. We're doing one on Korean poetry probably in the next month. If Amherst College, which sponsors us, had its way, the new Amherst College Press, and were their first publication, it would be strictly digital. And it would be free. The model but again, this is an academic press. And their thinking is, because Amherst College is such a wealthy institution, they can afford to keep scholarship going this way, they may as well. So they have to hire people to work there, and then the other costs are very low. I don't know if they're going to pay we pay our contributors. I don't know if they'll pay their authors, though. Right, I don't know. It hasn't happened yet. When we run the print issue, we have to raise the money ourselves. We do it through events, parties, donors, and of course sales and subscriptions. But really, we do need money from outside.
I was going to say that when I saw that question, it really made me look more to the past and how there's just a history of people always being worried about what's going to happen to the book and what is going to happen to authors and how, you know, horribly paid authors are. And one thing that came to mind was the paperback. I mean, paperbacks have not been around that long. I think they, you know, maybe late 30s, early 40s. I believe they were created for GIs so they could carry them around in their back pockets. And I'm guessing, even though I wasn't around, that at that time, people in the publishing industry were freaking out. Like, what if this is the only way that people are going to read now? And, it looks terrible, and it's cheaper. And then it evolved, and there were beautiful trade paperbacks. And books have always, there's just a progression of the different ways in which they've been sold. And people have always historically complained. So when it went from, the mom and pop nice little bookstore, which we all love, to the malls, everyone thought that was awful too, but actually more people were able to buy books. And now that a lot of people buy things on the internet, it's available to even more people. And even ebooks. I like to think that now people who wouldn't normally be reading things are reading them because it's so easy for them to get them. So even though I don't love the idea of reading things that way, and I really don't believe that books are going to disappear, I'm not against all these new things. But one thing that I did find, we're in the process of moving offices from the 14th floor to the 12th floor. We're going to a much smaller space, so we're sort of uncovering all these artifacts as we try and figure out what to throw away. And actually, I believe my father's been doing this since like 1956, not the 60s. So we literally were finding 1099s for our authors from the early 60s. He kept everything. But I just thought this was funny because I found this isn't that old. It's from 2001. I have to find the cover. From the LA Times book review, and it says, "Is publishing dead?" So,
what year is it?
2001. If you go through this, everybody is talking about the exact same things that they're talking about now, and they're worrying about electronic publication. And I worried about it too, but I feel pretty positive about publishing in general. I think that the most important thing is the author. And so as long as the author is around, and the author, if they're writing with a quill, or they're writing with a pencil, or they're writing with a ballpoint, or on their typewriter or on their computer, it doesn't matter because they're the most important thing. So as long as, even if it did turn out, it's not, I really believe it's not gonna happen that books were like only read on YouTube. It would still be the author would be the important person, and they'd still be getting their work out there. So.
Yeah, I think Valerie makes an important distinction, which is, you know, what's the, there's sort of, there's a business issue about publishing here, and there's an art issue about writing. And I certainly have zero fears about writing and literature. I mean, I guess there's an open question whether people like, whether there will be jobs for people like Valerie and me in 20 years, but that's not as important, except to me.
Or even my job either.
Yeah.
People be
here. I mean, I think, but, you know, I've worked at, I think the important thing for publishers in terms of the physical artifact, and we make more money on a print book than we do on electronic books, so our business models hinge on the existence of print in a pretty significant way. I think what's super important is the publishers have to make an object that's nice enough that people would rather buy it than buy an ebook. And you know, I've worked for three publishers in my, I've been publishing for 20 years, and I've worked for Ferris Grass and Giroux, Grey Wolf, and McSweeney's, and all three are places that take some care with the way they produce the physical objects. McSweeney's obviously to the point of fetishizing them, and I think the you know, they try to make it worth your money, and what's certainly happened in the industry over the past several years, and publishers were quaking in their boots about whether ebooks were going to eat into their revenues, but ebooks have kind of plateaued. The readers have now saturated the market. You know, the people who want, they're getting cheap enough for the people who really want a new reader can buy one. So we're seeing what the kind of level of desire is for the ebooks. And they were, you know, ebook sales were going like that for like several years, and now they've kind of gone like that. So I think the fear among publishers has subsided a bit. Certainly it surprised, I think, a lot of us who have been in the business for a while. I remember when I was a young editor at Ferris Grass and Giroux, I remember in the late 90s a couple of guys came in to present their fancy new electronic reading device called the Pocket, the Rocket eBook, or the Rocket eReader, I think it was called. And I remember they walked in our office with this thick, clunky thing that was book-sized, and they gave us one that we could sort of play around with, and so the guy in the rights department who had it invited us in to sort of play with it. And it, sort of, and it took ages for the pages to turn, you know, for the page to refresh, and it was sort of thick and heavy, and all of us at this, you know, fuddy-duddy old publisher were like, oh god, these things are no threat, they're horrifying, and nobody's going to want to read this way ever. And of course that changed radically, and now we see that lots of people do want to read that way. So one thing, I guess one other mini story I'll tell is, it was interesting, and there was, I mean, it's just evidence of what I was just saying, but while I was at McSweeney's, we published the, a book by David Byrne from Talking Heads called How Music Works, and he made, you know, a super nice looking book. It had this puffy cover, a lot of images, color images inside. It was really, you know, amazing sort of physical object. And it was a big bestseller. I mean, when you have bestsellers, the percentage of ebooks is quite a lot higher than it might be for your average novel. What was super interesting to me is we sold, it was like 15% were ebook, and we spent a lot of time making this ebook with audio files and all this stuff. People didn't buy it. You know, they wanted the physical book because we'd made something that was super nice looking. So I think I'll just end there. I think there will continue, you know, ebooks are going to be a major piece of the kind of writing that you guys are doing, and very important to our companies. And I think it's going to change, you know, move in directions that we still don't even, can't even really imagine. But I, it seems, I'm pretty confident that there's an ongoing and strong part of the market that's going to be print.
I just want to give you one example. I mean, probably our biggest backlist, best-selling book is Elie Wiesel's Night. And historically, it's always sold about a quarter of a million copies a year. And then when it was an Oprah selection, you know, went up to about half a million copies. What we're finding now is that it still sells a quarter million copies a year, but then there's a whole other ebook component, and they don't seem to be eating into each other. I don't know exactly why, but
we've definitely noticed that the ebooks sales eat into our paperback sales. So if we publish in hardcover, you know, we're selling fewer paperbacks and subsequently than we used to. So
well, I think it's different for older things.
Yeah, right.
I mean, we also have Aldous Huxley's Brave New World does tremendously well.
Course adoptions too. So.
Yeah. But you know, it's just easy. I just think the ease of being able to to get them. But I could, I mean, the price, it makes sense for paperbacks because of the price point. And you can get the, you can get the ebook as soon as the hardcover comes out.
Honestly, I'm just curious about the economics of it, because it occurs to me that you're right. The whole history of reading, at least in the West, is a history of enfranchisement through new technologies. You know, the Gutenberg press replaces all those monks in the scriptorium copy books and allows middle class to start buying them. Paperback allows people to own books for the first time. I'm sure there were many families who never bought a book and went to the library and never owned a book until a paperback came. Students would probably not keep their books unless they could keep a cheap paperback. So it's encouraging you to think that the Kindle and so on will enfranchise more people. But then there's the question of, and I'd be interested in John, hearing you talk about this, what the economics is of publishing online. Given your...
Ethan brought up a good point that the writers are the most important, and for us, we depend on the writers to make this product every 6 months, right? And we're, you mentioned some of the top name poets and writers that have sent us their work without even being solicited, most of them. It's, I think, half of the appeal, at least, is to be in something that looks this good, that has, the paper feels good, smells good even, especially when you open that box, it's fantastic. But very early on, and this is why I was glad that Amherst College Press picked us up, because my co-editors didn't agree, I wanted simultaneous online publication for free. And we delayed it by 6 months. But when we came into Amherst College Press, they said, you must do it. Okay. I was advised by Don Scher, who is now the editor at Poetry Magazine. And after Ruth Lilly gave that enormous gift, I'm sure some of you know, it was a couple $100 million. To the Poetry Foundation, which publishes Poetry Magazine, they saw their subscriptions increase, even as they made everything available free online. Of course, they've been around for a little while. You know, we're upstarts, but they were rejuvenated by this gift.
And you're getting yours free. You're getting your online presence free. So
yes, that's right. It's free. And we've had 7 issues. Our 8th is coming out soon. And at least 3 of them have sold out already. So we're doing okay. But we need Amherst College.
I'd like to ask another big general question, and we'll open things up to the rest of you. You three are in a position of seeing trends before anybody else sees trends. That is, what writers are sending and what people are printing, whether print means virtual printing or paper printing. And I wondered if you wanted to share with us what's happening right now. And I also wondered whether the two trends are intersecting. That is, what writers want to send you, is that what you as editors want to receive, or you as a literary representative want to be able to take to a publisher? Are those two different things? And I wonder whether things have changed in the 21st century in the United States. I'm really thinking since 9/11, since this is 9/11, because I expected to see it appear in our art. And of course it did in a very literal way. Right away, people were trying to rise to that occasion in poems and narratives and some not great films, but in novels and stories. But I think the powerful response to that still coming, still upon us, and will be arriving from some subterranean spot. And
one of the writers that I work with, this Irish writer, Kevin Barry, he was saying it at a sort of similar event to this. He was on a panel, and he was saying he always thinks it takes about 10 years for like an historical event to kind of filter its way effectively into art. So I think that's maybe right, that we still haven't seen some of the real responses to that period in our history.
I was thinking there might be a tonal change.
I remember people were loudly declaiming the death of irony immediately after 9/11. On about 9/16, I was living in New York then. I was working for FSG, and I ran into the writer Sam Lipsyte, who's a friend of mine, and ran into him in Union Square. His novel, he's a satirist, and among other things, but his novel had been published. Its pub date was 9/11. And days after that, people were loudly declaiming the death of exactly what he was doing. And he was, his publisher called him and said, we understand if you don't want to go on your tour right now. And he's like, no, I want to go on tour. So he's gone to have a perfectly fine career, so.
I don't really know about trends. I mean, what I'm seeing, and this is kind of obvious, I guess, is that, almost all the publishers are part of these huge conglomerates, and they're not, the editors, not something like great, but I mean, the editors, for the most part, can't make any kind of decisions on their own. Mm-hmm. They need to run everything by marketing and publicity and who knows what else. And what it leads to is that they're all looking not to the future in terms of what's going to sell for a long time, but they're looking for, what will make them, hopefully, and nobody really knows when you're buying something if it's going to be a big bestseller or not, but they're trying to second guess what's going to be a big bestseller because it looks good for them. And the editors are being fired and they're moving around, so they're not really thinking about the future either because they don't know in 5 years if they'll still be in the same place. And so what I do see is that everybody wants, or is, asking, big plot-driven, big characters, lots of stuff going on. They're not that interested, in the actual language necessarily.
Which is the opposite of what we.
Which is the opposite of what all of us are doing anyway. So we're definitely having, a tougher time. It takes longer. Most of the time it takes longer to find the right editor for a book than it used to. I know certainly 50 years ago it was like you had your friends in the business, you called them up, I know this is the right thing for you, and they would buy it. I think that they didn't even necessarily read it, especially with the French books that we were selling. If you called and said, this is a great book, it's in French, and they'd be like, well, if you say it's great, we'll publish it. So that's a big change. I mean, it's been going on for a while. I don't think it was affected by 9/11.
And are you seeing a surge in plot-driven poems?
No, I think the Western Mass.
I think it's more about accessibility.
It's the epicenter of post-avant poetry where I live, so.
Yeah, I don't know. I think for us, probably a zone that we're publishing a lot in and that we're doing quite well with is I think there has been a real resurgence in the essay and the kind of lyric essay writing. We're seeing a lot of hybrid texts that mix some, memoir and criticism. Is something that we've had quite a lot of success publishing them, whether that ranges from John DeGatta to Leslie Jameson recently, and I'm publishing next year Sarah Manguso and Maggie Nelson, and so we're doing a lot of these writers who are doing a really kind of creative sort of nonfiction that might not necessarily be very easily categorized. And I published the British writer Jeff Dyer, who also had kind of, I think, is pushing some of the lines between fiction and nonfiction in interesting ways.
That's interesting. Would you like to ask questions?
Oh, I'm sorry, Stephanie. I was making a joke. I am seeing more narrative poetry.
Oh,
that's cool.
You are seeing more. Are you publishing more narrative poetry?
I am. Yes.
Are you serious when you say that the language doesn't matter anymore? It's
secondary. It's not that it doesn't matter anymore.
Can you hear that?
It's not that it doesn't matter anymore.
So it's transparent style is sort of what people are starting to look for more than the elaborate style.
The question was, is transparent style more what people are looking for than elaborate style?
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're asking?
Yes, please.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know if I would put it in those words. I just think they want things that are really straightforward. People, they want things that are really more entertaining than educational, or they want to know that something's going to sell a lot of copies.
I would argue that in the kind of literary neck of the woods, where, you know, because Grable, we often look at the census first, I would guess. It's great if it has a story. I love stories, but, you know, the writing's got to be really good for us to publish it. And but so I would quibble with those two things being either incompatible with literary press, or, you know, I think it's just trends and style happen. And you know, for a while there might be a lot of kind of maximalist, big, looping, Faulknerian sentences, and then there might be some really stripped down, dirty realism, and those are both great kinds of writing. You know, and so I think Grey Wolf doesn't. You know, I think of some presses like, you know, Grove in the old days, or New Directions even now, had a very distinct sensibility. You know, they did a certain kind of writing, and Grey Wolf is probably more ecumenical. So we would do something that was either maximalist or minimalist, depending on if it was good.
Well, I think that's something that's changed too, that, you know, you used to be able to distinguish the different houses, and now, a lot of them are so similar that, you know, there's no difference. They're all doing the same thing.
A couple of questions, the first one is that if you have self-published a book, but it's been reviewed well by people who aren't your family or your does that make it harder to sell? Is that like a kiss of death in the old school publishing world?
Would you repeat the question, please?
I haven't dealt with self-published authors at all, but maybe that's the answer right there. The question was, if you've self-published a book and gotten good reviews that weren't from family members, is that the kiss of death? Like, is it possible to still get it published? I mean, it happens. You hear about it. I think that sometimes there are editors out there who are looking, you know, to see what's out there on the internet.
Yeah, I think at the big commercial houses, that's certainly happening more and more, that people are letting self-published authors kind of fight it out and see what works, and then they either pick up the author for a new book or republish the book that had been self-published in a smaller way.
Wait, the second part of my question is, and this goes to something other, you were saying the identity of the major publishers now. If a really undisputable masterpiece came out, like Ulysses, and everybody recognized it was a great book, how would that actually be marketed? Would you take it to a major house? I mean, would it be smoothed out? How would they handle a real old masterpiece if it came out today?
I'm sure they would handle it like almost everything they handle. They would have like no budget to, for publicity, and they would let it drop somewhere. I don't know that they would do something different for Ulysses than any other book.
I just want to say about Ulysses, Virginia Woolf turned it down for Hogarth Press. So,
I mean, I actually have another, like,
he had a hard time publishing. I also read recently an incident of his trying to publish Dubliners in Ireland on his last trip back to Dublin, and no luck there.
So I wanted to bring up, actually, with Elie Wiesel, I have a letter from Scribner's from 1958 that says, "Dear Mr. Borchardt, thank you so very much for giving us the privilege of reading Elie Wiesel's L'Ennemi. It is, as you say, a horrifying and extremely moving document. And I wish I could say this was something for Scribner's. However, we have certain misgivings as to the size of the American market for what remains, despite Mohiak's brilliant introduction, a document." So, I mean, for all I know, if Ulysses was being, you know, shopped around today, people would just be like, this is incomprehensible.
which a lot of people said then. I mean, what did people say that about? You know, Walt Whitman self-published Leaves of Grass. I mean, these are not news stories.
Stephen Crane paid people to read The Red Badge of Courage on the New York subways. And it didn't work. Got rich after he died. As many do. Right now, all green in the middle.
I was just wondering what you guys think about crossover between like literary and came out with something that really was on par with Ulysses, would she be able to get published by and read by like people who go for literary work rather than just commercial work? And I guess vice versa, although I guess there's more of a barrier sophistication-wise copying from commercial to literary.
We're talking about the crossover between literary and commercial.
I mean, I'm really happy when we have an author that we, you know, when we think all our authors are literary, even though it's kind of a bad word in the industry now. But, you know, when one of them turns out to do really well, which is, you know, when they're suddenly called commercial, we're really happy. I don't know if Ulysses is a great example, just because it's like, you know, if you're using something that difficult, but often we have authors who are complex and write beautifully, and you know, all of a sudden they're published by, you know, I had a book called The Year of Fog by a woman named Michelle Richmond, and I had trouble selling this book. It turned out to be a bestseller, the New York Times bestseller, but I sold it to Bantam, and it wasn't my first choice. And they saw the commercial potential in it, and it did really well, but it was still a literary novel. So there is crossover.
I think a lot of the kind of boutique imprints of the big literary publishers, that's exactly what they're looking for, is a book that's well-written, but that has, you know, interesting characters and good stories, and that's what they think can sell a lot of copies. So I'd say there's probably a publisher dying to read E.L. James for a literary audience. I mean, also, Vintage republished E.L. James, you know, one of the great literary publishers in the country.
Way in the back.
I've been waiting to get an editor in the room to ask this question.
Uh-oh.
I'm seeing more and more journals now doing what the Commons doing, where you've got both a physical presence of magazine and you have an online presence. And in many cases, some of the work that's published online never shows up in the print.
Excellent question.
And I'm wondering how you make that judgment as to which goes where, and if there's a value judgment that's moving there. Which
I do my best. I know exactly where you're going. I do my best because I'm also a poet. You don't want to be marginalized. I think the ideal is to have your poem appear in print, reprinted online, included in Best American Poetry, and then end up in your book. Okay. So I will never take anyone's work. Now we have different editors at the Common. Okay. I don't want to step on any toes, but I will never take anyone's work for online publication if I haven't already accepted it for print publication. Except in the last 6 months, because my backlog for print was 18 months long, and I wrote and I said, if you want to wait, okay, you can send it to me again in 18 months, or I can publish it within the next 3 to 6 months at the most online, and then we have a deal. You always send your work to me, and I'll get back to you quickly. It can come right to my email, and I'll do my best to get that poet's work in the print journal. But it's an excellent question, and I remember thinking that about 10 years ago when a couple of the big solid old quarterlies started doing that. I won't name them.
Started publishing things online that they would not.
They would say, well, we won't publish this in print, but we will include it online. And it was clear that that was a lesser form of publication, even though more people are going to read it.
I have a question for Valerie Borchardt and Ethan Jasowski. Do either of you see Evil Royalties as reaching 50% in the next 10 years?
She asked if either of us saw ebook royalties rising to 50% in the next 10 years.
Thank you.
I don't feel like I can predict the future, but I guess the short answer is probably not.
Is that because of the economics of the business?
Well, Ethan and I were just talking about this. It just kind of seems like it's plateaued to a certain extent. So, but it's so hard to say. In 10 years, we could be reading things completely differently. I have no idea what's going to happen in 10 years. So I hesitate to really
Yeah, I guess I would say that I think ebooks are, you know, the industry standard right now for ebooks is that publishers are paying 25% of the.
Well, is that what your question is? How much they're paying, or they, or is it 50% of? I'm sorry, maybe
the royalties.
Oh, we get 50% for something. Never mind. No, it's not the industry standard by any means, but yeah, if, especially. You know, with a lot of our books that were already under contract with publishers, where the contracts didn't have ebooks in them, you know, there are ebook companies that are giving 50%, but yes, I do see it going up to 50%, because we're seeing it a lot already.
Just a comment about that.
Oh, over
here. Oh, I'm sorry.
When looking at an unsolicited query, what is the minimum and maximum time, roughly, you will give unsolicited query? And is there any meta message behind the reasons that so many representatives give as the reason for rejecting? Can you read anything into a hidden message there? It's just,
I don't look at unsolicited queries. Yeah.
Mm. Does anyone in this group look at unsolicited queries?
Grail doesn't accept unagented prose. We do accept some unagented poetry, but it's trickier with probably with big book publishers rather than literary journals, say, which also get a lot of queries probably. I don't know. I mean, I think I wouldn't read too much in them. If they're very simple, then they're probably just not right for the person you sent it for, and you should move on and not overthink it. And never try to argue back and convince somebody, because what's the point?
But writers are always going to read rejection notices as if they were reading love letters.
The only, I mean, I guess the only, if somebody's actually read your
looking
work.
Looking for affirmation.
Look, I guess if somebody's actually read your work, you've gotten some response. If you're hearing, if you're having trouble getting an agent or something, and, you know, you're getting a million different responses. One person liked Bob, but didn't like Cindy, and the other person liked Cindy, but didn't like Bob, and one person loved the story, but not the writing, another person liked the writing, you know, if you're hearing just a wide range of responses, you just probably haven't found the right person and should keep plugging away. But if you're hearing kind of a similar sort of reaction, then you've probably got a problem you need to address before you send it back out.
Do you write notes to?
I write notes, yes. Although it's gotten harder because now everything is done electronically and we're given these forms. When I used to get paper submissions, I would always write something, or at least initial it so they knew that I saw it. And I read everything that comes to me.
And when you wrote those notes, were you just being nice, or did you hope that person would send something?
I was taking up my time.
Oh.
Right? Do you know? Seriously.
People do find my email address and send me unsolicited queries, and you know, I'll respond to them, even though technically we don't take them. But most of the time I'm rejecting them because something's just, the person's clearly not familiar with what we publish. So that is like the most common and annoying thing that happens.
So buy some or read some Grail.
Just know what we do. Yeah, right. I mean, it helps. You know, it's like, why would you submit to me?
When do you suggest emerging writers or new writers start sending out their work?
As soon as you're really happy with what you have. Like if it gets ready and it's finished and you're ready to let it out into the world, then you should send it out. Don't wait.
John, oh, absolutely. Soon. We were going in circles this morning and we kept coming back to this. Yes, if you're here for that purpose, you bet. You said vetted, right? You, Valerie, you said they were vetted already.
Some.
Okay.
As for his poetry journal.
Yeah, I feel like the lesser cousin now. When you're ready, you're ready. When you know where it should go, send it there. If you have to ask people, you need to go, you're not ready. If you need to ask, where should I send this? Go yourself and read them. I'm answering in terms of magazines. Go read the magazines. It's so easy now. You can get caught in a wormhole and find lots of different journals, even print journals, just spending an hour or two online. I say, though, go to the library, look at the print journals, and if you see where your work belongs, send it there.
I totally agree.
Mr. Krasowski, you mentioned that you've been seeing a rise in nonfiction and essays. Can you tell us more about that? Essays, of course, been very important. What kind of essays have you seen? What kind of essays do you select? And I invite all of those.
Well, I should say a lot of these things are starting in magazines, whether it's, you know, The Believer or Tin House or Granta or, you know, wherever. But I just think it's, I'm seeing a bit more formal innovation in some of the nonfiction essay writing than I'm seeing in fiction, where a lot of the sort of experimental work, I think, is similar, or what people are calling experimental work is awfully similar to the experimentation that's been going on for 40 years. So it's just, but it ranges. I mean, we do some essays that are, you know, pretty straightforward. I'd say, you know, Leslie Jameson's essays that have been really successful this year are, you know, fairly traditional essays, but from a perspective that feels a little bit new. Some of them are a little formally odder than others, but, and others go, you know, we're publishing a book by the poet Claudia Rankine that are effectively essays, although she's a poet, and they're much more lyrical, I guess I would say.
Do you want to talk about the kind of nonfiction you're...
Oh, I can't. I have nothing to do with it.
Yeah. Are you selling more nonfiction than...
We've always sold more nonfiction. I mean, nonfiction's always been easier to sell. We just need a good topic, so it's always been easier.
Yes.
I have sort of a personal question. What do you guys like? What are your opinions on the rise of young adult literature being read by all ages?
I'm not against anyone reading any kind of book for any reason. I guess my my only thing I would say, since I feel like I've been baited, is if you're an adult and that's the only kind of thing you read, I don't know. I mean, you know, challenge your thinking a little bit more.
That's harsh.
I'd say if it's the only thing. I mean, I just, you know.
I like your reading.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like, yeah, I agree that as long as you're reading something, it's good. It doesn't bother me. Some of those are very good books.
Yep. I just reread The Phantom Tollbooth several years ago. It was awesome. Really good book. Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a
young adult.
I guess that's a kid. That's a middle grade. I don't publish any young adult. I've never worked with a publisher. That's not true. FSG has an awesome children's list, but I've never edited any of those books, so it's not a realm that I know very well.
This is an honest question. Is there now young adult poetry?
I literally think I just read something about this the other day. I think there should be.
I have a colleague who calls certain literary poets, how else should I put this, well-known poets, YA poets, but it doesn't mean it as a...
I see.
Well, what about
Shel Silverstein?
Yeah, I was going to say Shel Silverstein. Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. Robert Sturgis. I don't know, it's all like...
Way in the back.
At what point do you think it's appropriate for writers to look for a literary agent as opposed to just sending out their manuscripts and stuff to their magazines?
You mean for story collections?
Sure, yeah.
At what point look for an agent rather than sending to magazines and publishers?
I think after you've had a little bit of success getting things published, it's a really fine line between, at least from the literary, like from when we want to take people on, it's a fine line because we don't want to take, it's risky for us to take someone on too early when they're not really ready yet. But at the same time, if we read someone and we see that they're going in the right direction and we have confidence, but we can't really do anything for them yet, it's a little bit too early, and then we worry that we're going to lose the opportunity to work with that person. because someone else invariably will snatch them up if they're really talented. But, you know, I would say after you've had a little bit of success getting some of those stories published somewhere, you know, so that you can at least get someone's attention by saying, you know, I've been in these 3, 4, or 5 places, and I feel like now I'm ready to have representation.
And your work will get better as you're edited. You'll learn more from the editors that you, hopefully, from the editors that you work with at the magazines, and then your work will get better, and you'll be better able to get an agent or a publisher. It depends what you're working on, too. You know, for poets, you just gotta publish in a lot of journals, you know, before you start, I mean, they don't have agents, but generally. You know, before you start looking for a publisher, I guess, you just gotta really rack up the publication credits. But if you're working on a novel that's super hard to excerpt, and you finished your novel and you're happy with it, and you can't think of how else to fiddle with it, then look for an agent. And get ready to hear no a lot.
Yeah, you have to have thick skin.
I was going to say that earlier, that if be ready to hear no also. Be sure that you can handle
it. Yeah,
that.
That's right.
How much of a role do agents play in actually shaping a manuscript?
Totally depends on the person, how much the author needs their work edited before it can be seen, how good the relationship is, how, you know, if, you know, some of my clients, I have a feel for how offended they're going to be by a suggestion that I might make, and others are really open to it and happy to get them. Some authors deliver things that are almost perfect, and some deliver things that are a mess, and, you know, you have to work with them before it goes out. So it really completely depends. There's no hard and fast rule.
Can we ask the same question of the editors? That is, how much does an editor, how much time can you or and will you spend with an author?
I mean, I try not to move a book into the production department if I still think it needs a lot of work. I mean, I try not to schedule it. So you try to do the work. You know, we certainly do a lot. Every place I've worked, there's been a lot of editing done. And I do hear about books that have just really not gotten edited or not edited well. I know it happens. But everywhere I've been, I watch editors working really hard. And now, what should be said is that, I'm sure this is true of agents too, that, you know, your day in the publishing industry is mostly taken by meetings, phone calls, and emails, and, you know, marketing meetings and God knows what, and editing and reading manuscripts usually happens at night or on the weekends. So it depends how much you want to work.
Aisha.
The question is for John. I was just thinking about there's so many new journals, and even
yes.
The common is fairly new.
Yes.
And there's so many journals around. Can you say why you want to create a common?
That's great. Yeah. The great question is, with so many, there are a lot of new journals, and with so many out there, why would you create a new one?
It wasn't my idea. But I jumped on really quick. Because you let me say something. My co-editor had the idea that she wanted to start a journal with the idea of place being central to the work, okay? And when she presented that to me, and then someone else asked me to do the poetry editing, okay? But I interpret that very loosely, and sometimes the site of the in question is the poem itself, okay? But what it did appeal to is my interest in Anglophone poetry from all over the world. Okay, and so with this interest in place, I said, as long as that means we can do a kind of atlas or a map of Anglophone poetry, that's great. We also do some translation, but our focus is primarily Anglophone work. So that's why I felt like I had the right or whatever to go ahead and create that. But the fact that there are so many journals should inspire you people who are just now starting to set out, right?
Yes, I was going to ask for last words before we break for the reception. Anything you wanted to leave these writers with? And maybe we should ask you how you get into your professions too. What if we want to be editors and agents?
I piled up a bunch of fairly useless literature degrees, and I did publishing. You know, I wasn't a writer, and I didn't want to teach, so publishing was all that was left for me. Honestly, that was kind of true. But you start as an assistant, and you just stay around long enough and hope to get promoted, which is what I did. I think the one thing I would say, there was been a lot of talk at the beginning of the panel about the death of literature and or death of publishing, or are people going to be reading? Where is writing going to happen? And I think it's actually a tremendously exciting time to be a writer. I think there's a lot of good writing going on and a lot of different ways to publish, more than there's been certainly in my lifetime. And as much as the industry is changing, I think this is super interesting moment, and I've seen tons of good work. And there's a legendary guy who works at City Lights Bookstore in San Francisco named Paul Yamazaki, who's been buying books there for this store for 30, 40 years. And they had their three best years in a row these last few years. And he thinks we're in like a golden age of good, interesting and good writing that we'll recognize later. So it depends who you ask and what your perspective is. But I do think, when I was growing up, it seemed like you have to be either like an experimental writer or a traditional writer or a commercial writer. You have to be one of these things. But it seems like there doesn't seem to be a sort of a dominant school of writing anymore to me. You can be such a magpie now and pick from experimental traditions and traditional traditions. I think this goes for poetry and fiction and nonfiction. So I don't know, it just seems like a great moment to where a lot of the tools that are in Writer's Toolkit are available to you.
In terms of becoming a literary agent, I guess it helps to be born into the family, which I really want to do. But the people who we hire, they studied literature. We're looking for people who are really, if you want to go into publishing, I'd say be really well read and love reading. And then, it's like anything these days. You go get an unpaid internship in a literary agency and hope that they take notice of what a great person you are when they hire you. And that is pretty much how we have hired people, so.
Yeah, but you have to be willing to work for nothing for a while. We met for something like 2 years before we even produced a single issue. It didn't help that we started at the end December of 2008. Okay, right after the crash. But you said leaving. I wanted to show you this. I brought a bunch of props, okay? This is The Wolf, and it's edited by James Byrne from the UK. And this is a poetry journal that also has essays, but it's strictly poetry oriented. This I only discovered it recently. This is more like what I have in mind. But they do include a lot of translation, and their focus is on global poetry, not just Anglophone.
So the book is going to survive. It's still alive. You have to have a day job, even if you're going to be an editor, break into editing, or agenting.
Or if you're going to write.
Or if you're going to write. I would also add, though, that this is. I think anybody writing in English is in a very lucky moment in the cultural history, because English is getting bigger every day. It's a welcoming language, and there are languages, and there are governments that are putting up their hands to stop new words from crossing the border. There have always been language reformers in other cultures, but there's no language reform in the United States, and maybe the language will be even richer tomorrow than it is today, and even richer next year than it is this year. So there should be a voice for everyone who wants to find a voice. I ask you now to thank our three.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.